Audio Service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for September 2013. This is issue number 344. I'm your host, Fred Vobey. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, McKenzie, Lima, Ohio, 45805. Email address for general inquiries is fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. My telephone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $30. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club, Incorporated. And send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. But subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone's assistance.
This is the AM Switch.
Welcome to the post-convention issue of the AM Switch, volume 80, number 29, starting off with call changes for existing stations. 1010 WLYT in Black Mountain, North Carolina, changes calls to WKJW. 1040 WWAM, located in Powell, Tennessee, makes a change to WJBE. The construction permit for the new station on 1190 in Red Oak, North Carolina, will be WNCR. Josh Owens, let us know when that one's on the air, please. 1210 KUNF, Washington, Utah, changes calls to KHKR. 1240 WFSX in Fort Myers, Florida, makes the switch to WFWN. The CP for 1380 in Santa Maria, California, has been assigned the call KVSM. 1490 KRKZ, Forks, Washington, is now known as KFKB. Here's a call sign that won't be gone long. 1580 WIFE, Connersville, Indiana, changes to WLPK. And here's a pop quiz. What Indiana city and frequency did that call sign reside on in the 1960s? Call the Musings line. And KLNQ, Evansville, Wyoming, has now changed calls to KKTS. Turning to new stations on the air, we have one. 1120 WKAJ, St. Johnsville, New York. This construction permit for new station running U4 with 10 kilowatts day and 400 watts night is now on the air. By the way, there are currently 65 outstanding CPs for new stations in the FCC online database, including 8 constructed CPs for which an application for a license to cover is pending, 8 expired CPs maintained in the database, presumably under appeal or review of some sort, and 49 active construction permits. Here's a list of CPs scheduled to expire in the next 30 days. CP for 1240 for Green River, Wyoming. CP for KACE, 1250 in Mesquite, Nevada. KVSM 1380, Santa Maria, California. CP for 1450 in Flora Vista, New Mexico. KCIK 740 in Hawaii. And a CP for 1240 in Altamont, Oregon. In most cases, within 2 weeks after the scheduled expiration date, a license to cover application is noted on the FCC website. Otherwise, the CP is deleted. Changes to existing stations, starting off with construction permits on the air. 540 WLIE, Islip, New York, is on with U4, 10,000 watts day, 220 at night. They were U4 with only 2,500 watts day, so you might want to listen around sunset for this one now. 820 WVSG, Columbus, Ohio, formerly WOSU, on the air with U2, 6,500 watts day, 790 watts night, raising their day power. 820 has been a two-site operation, but they're now broadcasting exclusively from the old night site. 970 WDAY Fargo, North Dakota is on with U4, 10,000 watts day and night from 5 kilowatts day and night. They moved to a new transmitter site southeast of Fargo and pushed that signal to the northwest. 1120 WMSW, Hatillo, Puerto Rico, makes it harder to hear as they've lowered their night power by taking down a tower. They're now U1, 2,600 watts day and 400 watts night. 1260 WGVM, Greenville, Mississippi, is on the air with U1, 2,400 watts day and a mighty 32 watts night. They were D1, 2,400 watts daytime, and night power had been authorized years ago, but not licensed until now. 1440 WHDM, McKenzie, Tennessee, on the air with U1, 420 watts day and 91 at night from a new transmitter site. 1460 WJAK, Jackson, Tennessee, on with U1, 800 watts day, 105 watts night, decreasing their power from 1,000 watts day and 128 at night. Constructed CPs now seeking final licensing. We start up in Durenberger country with 740 WDGY Hudson, Wisconsin. Applies for license to cover their CP for D3, 5 kilowatts. 840 KARS Belen, New Mexico. Granted program test authority for U1, 1,800 watts day and 30 watts night. They were on 860 with 1,300 watts day and 186 at night. 1260 WWRC, Washington, D.C., applies for license to cover CP and granted program test authority for U4, 35,000 watts day and 5,000 watts night. 1300 KAZN, Pasadena, California, applies for license to cover and granted program test authority for recently granted CP for U4, 23,000 watts day and 4,200 watts night. More on KAZN coming up. 1520 KYND Cypress, Texas has been granted program test authority for its CP with D4, 26,300 watts day and critical hours power of 18,000 watts. 1560 WYZD Dobson, North Carolina applies for license to cover CP for D1, 4,200 watts day, critical hours power of 510 watts. Construction permits granted include 580 WLES, Bonaire, Virginia, granted a CP for U1, 1 kilowatt day, 58 watts night from their existing site. 1230 WMOU, Berlin, New Hampshire, granted a CP for U1, 1 kilowatt day and 930 watts night. We talked about this one a minute ago, but 1300 KAZN, Pasadena, California, has been granted a construction permit for U4, 23,000 watts day and 4,200 watts night, all from their existing day site. 1590 WARV, Warwick, Rhode Island, granted a CP for U4, 8 kilowatts day and 5 kilowatts night from their existing site. Amendments to construction permits granted. 1330 WNIX, Greenville, Mississippi, granted a modification for a CP now for U1, 3,800 watts day and 55 watts night. 1420 WATB, Decatur, Georgia, granted modification for a construction permit to move to 1430 with U5, 15,000 watts day and 158 watts night. Applications for amendments to construction permits. One to report 650 WSRO, Ashland, Massachusetts, has a CP for U4, 1,500 watts day and 100 watts night, and is close to coming on the air, but hold the phone. They just applied for U4, 1,500 watts day and 187 watts night. Applications for new construction permits include 630 KTKK, Sandy, Utah, applies for U4, 935 watts day and 470 watts night, and a city of license change to Kearns, Utah. 680 WGES, St. Petersburg, Florida, applies for U1 930 watts day and 165 watts night from a shorter tower, which has been in use under an STA since 2000. 810 WJJQ Tomahawk, Wisconsin applies for U1 940 watts day and 12 watts night. 840 KXNT North Las Vegas, Nevada has an application for U4, 50 kilowatts day and 16,000 watts night. They amend their application to be U4, 50,000 watts day and 10,000 watts night. 1320 KSDT, Hemet, California applies for U4, 550 watts day, 950 watts night, and a city of license change to Redlands, California. 1340 WXFN Muncie, Indiana, applies for a new tower, still U1, 1,000 watts day and night from the same site. 1340 KRMD Shreveport, Louisiana has an application for U1, 396 watts day and night, but now they've amended it to U1, 400 watts day and night. 1450 KFLS Klamath Falls, Oregon applies for a city of license change to Tula Lake, California, but will remain U1, 1,000 watts day and night. And 1600 WTZQ Hendersonville, North Carolina applies for U1, 5,000 watts day and 30 watts night, and will take co-owned WFIS 1600 Fountain Inn, South Carolina off the air if the CP is granted. So better try for WFIS before it fizzles out. CP's expired or applications dismissed. 630 WREY, St. Paul, Minnesota, the old KDWB, had a CP for U4 2300 watts day and night, but the CP expired and was deleted by the FCC, so they remain U4 1000 watts day and 2500 watts night. 710 WNTM, Mobile, Alabama, this long-standing application for U2 6,000 watts day and 2,100 watts night has been dismissed. 1210 KHKR Washington, Utah has a CP for U1, 10 kilowatts day, 231 watts night. Right now they're 10 kilowatts day and 250 watts night. The CP expired and now the station applies for a new CP to replace it. And finally, 1550 KMAD, Mattel, Oklahoma's CP for a new site has expired and has been deleted. These stations are leaving the air. 640 KGVW, Belgrade, Montana. License canceled, calls deleted as of July 1st, with no explanation given on the FCC website. 850 KXCM, Waterloo, Iowa. This station was deleted some years ago and has now finally been dropped from the database. 1240 KPBL, Hempel, Texas. This silent station's license is now canceled, calls deleted, station failed to file for renewal, so the license expired as of August 1st. 1340 KIHN, Hugo, Oklahoma. License canceled, calls deleted, station failed to file for renewal. License expired as of June 1st. 1440 KELG Manor, Texas. License canceled and calls deleted. They failed to file for renewal and the license expired August 1st. 1490 WJDJ Hartsville, South Carolina. License canceled, calls deleted. Station's been silent since June 2nd of last year and lost their license for being off for more than a year. 1560 KTXZ, West Lake Hills, Texas. License canceled, calls deleted. Station failed to file for renewal. License expired as of August 1st. And 1600 KOKE, Pflugerville, Texas. License canceled, calls deleted. They failed to file for renewal, and their license expired as of August 1st. You'll notice that it's often the case when a station fails to file for renewal, there may be extenuating circumstances that will lead the FCC to grant an STA to continue operations until the licensing issue is worked out, or even to the FCC eventually granting a license, sometimes for a shorter period and usually with a hefty fine. Sometimes the check to the FCC bounced. Sometimes the person who was supposed to do the renewal filing at a small station was out sick. Sometimes the station's operations are just dysfunctional. So cross these out with a pencil for now. Silent STA. These stations have definitely gone silent. 580 KZMX, Hot Springs, South Dakota, finally added to the silent list. They've been off since April 26th for staffing reasons. 580 WLVA, Lynchburg, Virginia, applies for silent STA. They've been off since June 26th, pending a sale. 620 WJHX, Lexington, Alabama, went silent July 15th when the station was vandalized and the transmitter was stolen. Does anybody know where Phil Wayne was that night? 750 WPDX, Clarksburg, West Virginia, filed for silent station notification. 960 WGRO, Lake City, Florida, went silent July 12th as the husband and wife station owners are too ill to broadcast. 1130 WALQ, Carville, Alabama, applies for silent STA. They've been off since July 19th for economic reasons. 1190 KPHN, Kansas City, Missouri, went silent July 31st, pending a sale by Radio Disney. 1300 WBOW, Terre Haute, Indiana, went silent July 19th after their transmitter's power supply unit failed. 1340 KOLE, Port Arthur, Texas, applies for a silent STA. They've been off since July 19th after losing their studio location. 1390 WZQQ, Hazard, Kentucky, applies for a silent STA after going silent July 20th because of transmitter problems. 1450 WZGX, Bessemer, Alabama, like co-owned WJHX 620. They've been silent since July 15th due to theft of transmitter. Although the station owner's letter to the FCC refers to the station as WGHX 1450 AM in Bessemer, Alabama. And 1450 WTOD, Hartsville, South Carolina, applies for silent STA. They've been silent since July 15th after losing their antenna site. These formerly silent stations are back on the air. 840 WHGH, Thompsonville, Georgia. They returned on June 10th. 910 KLCN, Blytheville, Arkansas. Back on since July 1st. 1000 WDXZ, Robertsdale, Alabama. Returned to the air on August 3rd. 1110 WOMN, Franklinton, Louisiana. Returned on June 30th. 1300 WIBR, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, returned to the air August 6th with an STA, presumably not for long. 1400 KENT, Parowan, Utah, back on since June 19th. 1440 WCDL, Carbondale, Pennsylvania, returned on August 6th. 1490 WTKE, Milton, Florida, returned with low power from a backup transmitter July 12th. 1520 WLGC, Greenup, Kentucky, returned to the air with an STA July 20th. 1530 WLWB, New Holstein, Wisconsin, returned to the air August 7th, testing a new CP for D1 350 watts. 1560 KNGR, Dangerfield, Texas, belatedly removed from the FCC silent list. And 1580 KAMI, Cozad, Nebraska station, silent since August 10th, returned to the air on June 8th. Canadian news now via Dan Siss, Sean Axelrod, and the World Radio TV Handbook. 860 CBRL, Williams Lake, British Columbia, applies to move their AM LPRT to 92.1 FM. 900 CKBI, Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, applies for U1, 10 kilowatts day and 2,800 watts night from a new site. 990 CHRF, Montreal, Quebec, the CP for this new station applies for U4, 50,000 watts day, 10,000 watts night on 980, where Montreal 990 once was 20 or more years ago. And a new station will be on 1610 in Montreal. The application for the new station will presumably be U1, 1,000 watts day and night, with an ethnic format, South Asian format. And that's a wrap on AM Switch. Let's see if you get the question I posed earlier, and let's hear from you on silent stations or stations coming back on the air. Call the Musings line, 419-741-0205. Call anytime to leave your message. For now, I'm Dave Alpert in Los Angeles, turning it over to our past convention host, Mark Durenberger.
National Radio Club.
Thank you, Dave. This month, we've been asked by Fred to present a convention report on the what turned out to be a highly successful 2013 Joint DX Convention in Minneapolis. The 2013 convention was singular in several respects. First, NRC, IRCA, the Minnesota DX Club, and the WTFDA members came together in a historic confluence of talent and diversity. Second, we decided to take the best ideas of the club's previous conventions and then move beyond those traditions to create a learning and sharing experience. And finally, as a major recurring agenda item, we promoted and encouraged an undercurrent of discussion on the future of our respective clubs. It all came together quite nicely on a sunny weekend at the Bloomington Holiday Inn in Minneapolis and at the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting. From an ambience perspective, the hotel was a great place to stay and work, and as for the museum, well, that was a singular experience in itself. Members began arriving on Wednesday, July 31st, to spend advance time at the baseball parks, the Mall of America, and other Minneapolis-area attractions. Meanwhile, your friendly convention coordinators were stuffing greeting packs with convention and area information. We were gathering auction items and door prizes and filling coolers and snack bowls. Thursday evening's convention activities began with a successful de-expedition hosted by the Minnesota DX Club at Lac La Vang Park in Burnsville. About 25 members, that was most of the registrants who had arrived by that point, carpooled to the site with their radios and an expectation that conditions ought to be semi-okay given it's summer. The site was electrically quiet, but the mosquitoes generated their own interference, seemingly singling out special victims in spite of the clouds of bug spray. Those of us ignored by the airborne vampires watched and learned as Neil Kazaros displayed a phased beverage on the ground, a bog, as well as a single Kaz antenna array. We also pulled out a single 500-foot bog about due east, and we set up a 30-foot vertical. Richard Allen brought an FSL antenna, and folks learned how to couple the antenna to their radios, hot-rodding them. We struck the set out there just before 10 o'clock. Friday morning, we began our classroom experience at 8:30. We note this was 6:30 Pacific time, and our West Coasters were forgiven for yawning. Nick Hall-Patch presented what he creatively calls the DX Fish Barrel. It's an innovative methodology using SpectraView for analyzing short-term, medium-wave, and long-wave signal trends, so you can note when they're starting to come up through the noise. His application, as demonstrated, is used in Trans-Pacific Watch. It's a most useful tool, and an application that will probably become mainstream. Neil Kazaros joined the dialogue with an interesting presentation on how to use widely available local sunset maps and a basic understanding of geography to predict where medium-wave signal paths were likely to be opening or closing. It was one of those situations where a number of us were saying, gee, I knew that, but I had forgotten about it. So Kaz brought it back home to us. The proof is in the capture, as they say, and Kaz played audio clips of some of the signals resulting from his approach when tuning in Illinois. They reached all the way to the West Coast. By now, we were running up against a self-imposed clock. We had to finish by 11:30, so your friendly author's own paper on short medium-wave antennas and noise hunting was mercifully truncated. I think I got about halfway through before the dinner bell rang. At 11:30, we repopulated the meeting room with our hardcore members who enjoyed a fascinating IEEE luncheon presentation on metamaterials for new antenna design. We were also treated to a video on aerospace systems from Saturn V to 21st century drone warfare. And we thank Chris Fuller of the IEEE for sponsoring that lunch. The world-famous group photo came off as scheduled, with 40 of our 60-person group standing in the sunshine. A few folks were off doing other things or just checking into the hotel. Carpool drivers then loaded their machines for the trip to the museum, where we enjoyed a fascinating tour of the artifacts and history of wireless communications, including a working spark gap transmitter. Docent Steve Raymer warned us to shut down phones and PDAs to keep them from being incinerated by the spark. Friday afternoon's tutorials began with Nigel Pimblett's tour of Don Moman's antenna farm in Alberta, VE6JY. Towers and antenna arrays cover most of 80 acres of land. The site is available for ham contesting and even scientific research. We called it the ultimate labor of love. While we were recovering from our envy, Phil, by the way, was setting up to deliver a paper on the FSL antenna. Phil's clear presentation was a great way to learn about a new antenna idea that seems to be revolutionizing one category of ultralight efforts. Richard Allen, as I mentioned, carried a 7-inch version to the conclave. Clearly, a lot of work to build, but apparently quite worth it. Now, Kaz returned, taking us through theory and practice on practical antennas. His paper included antenna diagrams, azimuth and elevation drawings of pickup patterns from Kaz antennas, flags, double delta antennas, and more. This presentation was of great value to anyone who has the space to deploy these antennas. And those folks who did, who want to take that next step, were given a great deal of information. We capped the afternoon's classroom sessions Friday with George Sherman's introduction to the new CR1 receiver, touted as an SDR without need for a computer. Excellent specs, and George demonstrated a good understanding of its performance while adding comments on the radio's good and not-so-hot points. Well, while this should have been enough for any healthy DXer, we were just hitting our stride, swinging now into the informal part of our first day. And I must add that, to everyone's credit, we didn't seem to be burning anyone out. Now came a healthy indicator of emerging club and inter-club solidarity. The clubs held sequential business meetings, with everyone from all clubs invited to attend all club meetings. This was a nice indication that long-ago personal baggage about club relationships may have been jettisoned. When the IRCA announced its 50th anniversary convention in Billings next year, several members asked why we couldn't continue this new tradition of joint conclave. The NRC unanimously voted to forward an expression of interest in joining IRCA in Billings for another joint convention in 2014. Somewhere before, during, or after this meeting, the attendees devoured a few dozen pizzas provided by the museum. About 13 minutes after the pizza boxes were opened, it looked like a tornado had come through and vacuumed up all the food. While attendees digested all that wonderful cholesterol and trans fat, we presented as dessert a video trip to the Utah desert, in which two fools in the field laid out some serious wire while having fun on ATVs. The video showed how we used a single-wire, remote-adjustable termination system to null out backside beverage response. It was obvious from the video your friendly fools did a lot of dumb things on that trip. Ideas for better techniques were forthcoming from the audience. We did manage to lower the conversation level in the room when we put up the maps of our captures. Now it was time to open the door on the aforementioned underlying agenda item, the future of the clubs. The healthy attitudes displayed during our earlier business meetings made it easier for moderator Skip Dabblestein to get some great responses to two questions. What do we do to make our clubs sustainable in view of the graying of the membership? And what services should our clubs be offering our constituents? It was a healthy and productive session. And if you're interested, a recording is available. Well, by this point, late Friday evening, only the stout-hearted fanatics were ready for any more, so mercifully we invoked an immediate end to the day's services and returned to the hotel for gab fests. Saturday arrived more or less on schedule, as it tends to do every week or so here on the Norwegian Riviera. We were gratified to see most of Friday's survivors show up at the museum for the 9 a.m. start. We began with the quest for the perfect loop, Mike Bates and Jim Dale showed us real-life artifacts of their years of experimenting with loop construction. They also shared their hard-earned conclusions and offered suggestions for physical construction. It was clear these guys are really into loop antennas. Then it was time for singer, guitarist, marketer, ham DXer Steve Kramer, KN0F, to take us on a tour of shortwave listening. Steve's comments were entertaining and informative. There's still a lot left to hear out there. Steve Raymer, our museum host, told us how the place came together. A fascinating story, and it credits, among others, Earl Bakken, inventor of the pacemaker, with seeing the potential of the museum as a learning institute. Each year, the Pavic Museum is host to more than 6,000 school kids who are exposed for the first time to the magic of wireless. Next, Phil Bytheway explained the state-of-the-art of the ultralight hobby and the qualifying rules applying thereto. Phil was kind enough to display and distribute a guide to ultralights, and our would-be ultralighters took copious notes. There is a lot more to this hobby and its organization than some thought. The formal sessions concluded with George Sherman's dissertation on loafers and beacons. George explained why Down Under is still a decent, if underexplored, part of the spectrum and a goal for hobbyists jaded with the other bands. His information included a look at a great reference site. I'll give it to you here. As it is, you don't need a www in front of it, but here it is. CLASSE.com/DX/NDB/RNA. That's all you need to put in your browser. As long as we were noodling around down there close to D.C., I asked Craig Siegenthaler, Mr. Kiwa, to tell us what he was doing at the super low end. Turns out he's listening to lightning and earth motion in the band of zero to a few hertz. Turns out many folks were interested. Came now the open Saturday afternoon. One station tour planned. The logistics of motoring around this large market made it impractical to reach more than one site in the time available. But that one site was a goodie, the transmitter of WCCO 830. Most of the group went on the tour. Lots of photos were taken. And if you're interested in photos, contact one of your friends who was there. At the WCCO site, three transmitters in the main building. An alternate tower site several miles distant contains two more. It was noted the main tower is too long for 830. WCCO was on 810 prior to the 1941 NARBA switch, and the tower was never shortened to 830's optimum frequency. Thanks to WCCO chief engineer Craig Walters and his fluorescent light bulb. Saturday evening, the Holiday Inn impressed us with their catering at a very nicely appointed banquet. Excellent meal, good conversation. Banquet speaker Dean Sorensen, a longtime broadcaster and multiple station co-owner, regaled us with stories about his early days and about the characters he's met along the way. Dean is a DXer himself and could relate nicely to our hobby and the current state of the clubs. Then, as folks checked to make sure they had their wallets at hand for the auction, we gave out a number of cool door prizes. To be eligible for a prize, you had to complete the anonymous program survey in which we asked for comments on individual papers. Results of that survey are following here in just a minute. Door prizes went to Steve Kramer, the 20th edition of the FM Atlas. Discovering DXing was handed to Ernie Wasilowski. The puns in the group said we ought to have Ernie relabel this Rediscovering DXing. The book Pirate Radio was won by Nigel Pimblett. Subscriptions to CQ Magazine were captured by Neil Griffin and Wayne Heinen. Somebody won a gift certificate, $50, from ARRL. I can't decipher Skip's writing, so I can't tell you who it was. But David Jones won a $25 version of the same. The FR-160 radio went to Neil Kazaros. CC Radio's EP was won by Paul Swearingen, and the CC Radio 2 went to Richard Allen. We again thank our sponsors for these generous contributions. The club auction did very well. Colonels Phil Bytheway and Paul Swearingen were ably assisted by David Yosis and myself. David and I donned green eye shades and raked in the club-supporting revenue from your purchases. The club merchandise donated by members brought in over $400. A separate auction in behalf of the Pavic Museum included a Kenwood TS-520S, which Jim Dale purchased. Well done, all, and thank you. There's a big yellow warning sign on Interstate 70 eastbound, high above Denver. It says, "Truckers, you're not down yet." Sunday morning's message, "We're not done yet." The endurance test began at 9 a.m. The Great DX Quiz, prepared by MC Scott Feibusch, was one of the toughest exams administered in quite a spell, and with such glee on Scott's part. The winners for Part 1 were Garrett Woolman. He had 19 points. Part 2, John Sampson with 36 points. Part 3, your usual Frank Merrill with 11 points. The grand finale was worth the wait. The Scott Feibusch Tower Tour was a fascinating mix of tower photos and station information, all presented in context. It's clear to this old grizzled head that Scott is a living, breathing encyclopedia of up-to-date station data, AM, FM, and TV. Woe betide those who challenged the master, as was demonstrated by the low quiz scores. And at that point, we made our goodbyes and thanked everyone for coming. From what I can tell out here in Lake Wobegon, the four-day duda was a great success. Some statistics. We were 60 registrants of all ages from all areas of the U.S. and Canada. A few were convention newbies. A majority of us belonged to more than one club. 39% of the club members of the registrants belonged to the NRC, 25% to IRCA, 20% to the Minnesota DX Club, and 16% said that they belonged to WTFDA. Of the papers presented, 7 dealt with medium wave, 3 with long wave, 1 focused on short wave, and the remainder were of general interest. We couldn't find an FMTV presenter from among the ranks of WTFDA, and so we addressed their interests with a great handout. We felt this was probably a good ratio of topics, but we also wanted to make sure to add something new. Let's see how we did. Anonymous program surveys. All attendants were given a program survey form to be executed for each session. The intent was not to see which presenter came out on top, but rather to audit the interest in each topic as a baseline for future conventions. Because these had to be turned in Saturday evening to qualify for door prizes, the DX Quiz and the Scott Feibusch Tower Tour were not represented. But I'll exercise reporter's prerogative and give Scott's unrated Sunday work a must-repeat. In the survey, attendees were asked to value each presentation by circling as many of the following comments as were appropriate. I'll give you numbers. These were the totals for each comment submitted. Comment, "I learned something new." 389 people circled that. "I'd like to know more." 155. "I had little interest in this." 39. "I'd like to try this myself." 141. "It was too long." 40. "It wasn't long enough." 20. "I didn't understand it." Only 3. "I enjoyed the presentation style." 345. And the final comment, "On the whole, I'd rather be in Philadelphia." 0. The total potential score was 658. That would be the number of presentations multiplied by the number of surveys returned. Some folks didn't attend all sessions. Presenters can get details from me if interested. My interpretations of this admittedly non-scientific survey, the high scores in "I learned something new" and "I'd like to know more" tell us that we were pretty much on the mark in designing the program agenda. This may also account for why most folks weren't wiggling too much in their seats during the papers. The high presentation style numbers reflect the terrific work our presenters put into crafting their papers and the quality of their audio-visual offerings. It was a lot of work putting these presentations together, but it appears y'all appreciated the work. Now the great thank yous. I want to once again express our appreciation to presenters Nick Hallpatch, Neil Kazaros, Phil Bytheway, Nigel Pimblett, Skip Dabelstein, George Sherman, Jim Dale, Mike Bates, Steve Kramer, Steve Raymer, and Scott Feibusch. Thanks to Dean Sorensen for an entertaining after-banquet presentation. To Steve Raymer, Danny Henry, and Courtney Bakken for their outstanding hospitality at the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting. And to WCCO Chief Engineer Craig Walters for the great tour. We also recognize the convention coordination team, including Phil Bytheway, Skip Dabelstein, Todd Skane, Ernie Wesolowski, Jim Dale, and Mike Bate. And a special vote of appreciation goes to the Minnesota DX Club for hosting the DXpedition and for providing technical and informational support throughout the convention. A note of gratitude is directed to the IEEE, Twin Cities Microwave Chapter, for supporting our Friday lunch and for providing fascinating futuristics. And finally, our appreciation for the unselfish carpool drivers who made getting around our venues a whole lot easier. This was truly a team effort. Your friendly correspondent, who was the host for the convention, is currently hiding in the North Woods, recovering, but responding to email at mark4@durenberger.com, M-A-R-K-4 at D-U-R-E-N-B-E-R-G-E-R.com. And that's our 2013 convention report from the horse's mouth, I guess. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you were here. We were glad to meet so many of you, and we feel bad that we didn't have a chance to spend more time getting to know you. We'll see you again next month over most of this same CD. Until then, good listening, DXers.
The DX Audio Service.
We're finally learning something we can use.
There's nothing else quite like it.
Really?
AM radio will grow and change, just like America. An essay by Tom Callahan, President, Southern California Broadcasters Association. Daniel Flynn's AM radio signing off from American Spectator, which Don posted on his site Tuesday morning, offers a version of AM radio that is not supported by the facts of AM radio listenership today in Southern California and the rest of the country as well. AM radio is not dead. Indeed, the facts prove that AM radio remains a constant companion and close friend to millions of L.A. metro area fans of general market news talk, Spanish news talk, sports, and the quietly growing but rarely talked about multicultural audience. The Asian influence is growing all over the country. In brief, much like a changing America, the audience and ethnic background of AM radio listenership is ever evolving, and fortunately for AM radio, perfectly positioned for more growth. Let's begin with a few solid facts about AM radio in the LA metro area, the largest radio revenue market in the United States and home to almost 10 million people in LA County, also the largest populated county in the U.S. From the first quarter 2008 through second quarter 2013, the 22 AM radio stations that offer original programming here in the LA metro area have shown only the slightest of audience loss over the past 5 years. We can't go back any further, as anything prior to third quarter 2008 was with Arbitron's diary method, and to compare PPM data to diary data in a large market like LA is not fair to either side. In third quarter 2008, AM radio's weekly cum listenership was 3,766,300 persons 12 plus. By second quarter 2013, that same listenership stood at 3,319,400, a loss of only 466,900 listeners that took place over 5 years. Stated as a percentage of the total LA listenership, that's 34.5% of the population in 2008 versus 30.1% as of second quarter 2013. That's hardly the death of AM radio. It's more like a summer cold, if you follow the seasonality of AM radio in Southern California. Had Mr. Flynn consulted with us prior to publishing his blog, we would have urged him to focus his attention on the sweeping ethnic and demographic changes happening now in America and how AM radio will directly benefit from those changes, as it has for the past 100 years. Let's talk about today's dynamic AM radio audience. In Southern California, over 40% of the population is now Hispanic. That's 9 million people and growing. Any wonder why 15 of the 100 AM stations in Southern California offer Spanish programming? In Southern California, 12.9% of the population is now Asian. That's over 2.5 million people and growing. In Southern California, there are 8 Asian AM radio stations programming in 5 different dialects to over 2.5 million Asian Americans, all on the AM dial. The aging demographics are a reality all over the country, with U.S. birth rates at its lowest since World War II, and yet the L.A. metro area has 11% of the population 65 years old and up. Yes, older people listen to AM radio, and yes, as a demographic, this generation of 65-plus citizens has more disposable income than any previous generation ever. Does anyone in 2013 really think this burgeoning group of American citizens listens only to FM radio? In this mega city and region, with our enormous traffic conditions, multiple languages, and this much diversity of culture, heritage, and interests? And now, let's look at the rich heritage and adaptability of AM radio. AM radio has reinvented itself time and time again for a changing America over 10 decades. AM radio began almost 100 years ago with radio soap operas, big band concerts for major ballrooms all over the country, then added comedy, and in times of national crisis, our nation turned to AM radio to hear FDR, who proclaimed on air, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself," calming a nervous nation during the Depression. His fireside chats, heard only on AM radio, convinced a very weary nation that a new deal was coming. Since then, AM radio introduced play-by-play sports coverage, weather reports, farm and futures reports, which were critical for the agricultural economy we thrived on back then, and also launched the careers of radio's brightest stars, with each decade ushering a new level of audience appeal. Just as AM radio evolved out of Top 40 back in the 1960s, it has morphed into new formats and found an entirely new audience to appeal to. Please keep the following in mind when you consider the death of AM radio. The explosion of sports talk formats happened only on AM radio. The creation and proliferation of all talk formats happened only on AM radio. All surveys on the subject indicated that people listen to AM radio as a primary source for breaking news, sports, and the stock market. The most successful syndicated talk shows in the country can mostly be heard on AM radio. Many AM radio news talk formats can be heard in over 10 states, thanks to AM modulation that travels over mountains and booms 50,000-watt transmissions from 6 p.m. to 5 a.m. every day. Religious spoken word programming of all kinds is heard mostly on AM radio. The all business formats began and can only be heard on AM radio. All mass appeal car manufacturers continue to offer AM radio in their new models with no plans to change the AM/FM radio offering. As it has demonstrated for 100 years, AM radio survives and thrives because it changes with its audience and all the while inventing and reinventing new formats and programming for an ever-changing America. Get ready for more innovation from AM radio that will excite, inform, and entertain millions of new listeners and new generations of AM radio fans to come. AM radio, growing and evolving just like America.
Art Bell to return to the air. According to a posting by Art Bell, W6OBB, on Facebook, he will be returning to nighttime talk radio this fall. But you won't be hearing him on your AM or FM dial. That's because Bell's new program will be a part of the Sirius XM satellite subscription program lineup. More information was provided in an article on the BigStory.com website. It says that a Sirius XM company representative contacted Bell through social media a few months ago. This, in turn, led to the creation of Bell's new show to be titled Art Bell's Dark Matter. Sirius XM says that Bell will talk about things like UFOs, ghosts, near-death experiences, and the weird aspects of science. Also, that he will do interviews and take calls from listeners. Like in years past, the show will originate from Art's property in Nevada. Sirius XM is reportedly in the process of building a new studio facility for him to originate from. Meanwhile, back on Facebook, W6OBB posted that he could not say a word until now. He added that he tried to tell his followers on Facebook that it was coming without spilling the beans because he had been sworn not to. He also directed those interested to see his website at artbell.com for more details.
FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai continues to impress those who enjoy AM broadcasting and those who own AM stations. Recently, he made his way to KDKA, allegedly the first radio station in the United States. Here are his comments made at the Pittsburgh Radio Broadcasters Roundtable, July 24th, 2013. It's great to be here today at KDKA meeting with Pittsburgh broadcasters. I can't think of a better place to talk about radio. KDKA's history on the air can be traced all the way back to November 1920. On that day, from a shack in the top of the K building of Westinghouse's East Pittsburgh plant in Turtle Creek, Leo Rosenberg announced live returns of the presidential election between Warren G. Harding and James Cox. This broadcast was historic. Not only did it announce what I am pleased to note was a landslide Republican victory, it also heralded the dawn of a new age as America's first commercial radio broadcast. After that first broadcast, KDKA didn't simply jag around, to borrow a term of Pittsburghese. Instead, it kept innovating. KDKA broadcast the first professional baseball game right here in Pittsburgh. On August 5th, 1921, Harold Arlen relayed the play-by-play as the Pirates beat the Phillies 8-5. The first ever football broadcast came 2 months later as KDKA listeners heard the Pitt Panthers beat the West Virginia Mountaineers 21-13. Once again, Harold Arlen called the action. Radio show formats that are commonplace today were developed right here, too. Do you enjoy listening to Randy Bauman on the DVE Morning Show? Well, the idea to use comedy to help wake up listeners was first developed by Reggie Cordick on Cordick & Company in the 1950s. Guests like Omicron the Alien and Carbon Monoxide the Taxidermist made regular appearances. What about radio talk shows like the Glenn Meekham program on WPGB? Ed and Wendy King came up with the idea in 1951, and their Party Line program ran for 21 years. KDKA has pushed the envelope, not just from a content perspective, but also a technological one, debuting stereo sound on commercial AM in 1982. Pittsburgh's pioneering achievements in radio aren't limited to KDKA. In 1948, for example, WHOD's Mary D. Dudley became the first African-American female DJ in the United States. On her show, Mary played the latest records by African-American artists, introduced local talent, and interviewed national figures like Cab Calloway and Jackie Robinson. Today, you can find excellent radio across the dial around Pittsburgh and throughout our nation. What began in that shack on top of the K building has developed into the audible core of our national culture. Just like Pittsburgh's world record 446 bridges, radio connects people. Whether it's playing the latest track from Pittsburgh's own Christina Aguilera or Wiz Khalifa, reporting on local news, or providing play-by-play of a Penguins game, radio helps to build a city's cultural identity. And it's a critical source of local information. To broadcasters, localism isn't just a slogan, it's your way of doing business. Like the legendary Steel Curtain, radio serves as an essential line of defense in times of emergency. From the St. Patrick's Day flood of 1936 to the flooding that hit Pittsburgh just a few weeks ago, radio has proven itself to be a quick, efficient, and reliable means of getting emergency information out to the public in times of need. When other emergency sources fail, radio comes through. When the 2010 blizzards left over 130,000 people in the Pittsburgh area without power, battery-powered radios gave residents information about cleanup, power restoration efforts, and where to go to seek shelter. But I didn't come here today just to reminisce about the past or report on the present. Instead, I want to talk about the future. This afternoon, I want to hear your views on how we can ensure that what began in Pittsburgh in 1920 continues to be a vital part of our media landscape. And I'm particularly interested in learning what you think the FCC can do to help. To get things started, let me highlight a few issues that have been on my mind. During my time in office, I've made it clear that I am a big fan of AM radio. But the AM band is facing significant challenges. Every day it gets harder to pick up a clear AM signal. The percentage of listening done on the AM dial has sharply declined, especially among the young. That's why I have called for the FCC to launch an AM radio revitalization initiative. We need to comprehensively review our AM radio rules and explore proposals for improving the band. Over the course of the last 10 months, I've heard great ideas from broadcasters across the country, and now is the time to take action. In recent weeks, I've had very productive discussions with FCC Chairwoman Mignon Clyburn about AM radio. She is a friend to broadcasters, and I'm hopeful that we will see progress in the coming months. In every field, it's important for the FCC to make sure that our regulations keep up with the times. But especially when it comes to radio, we're overdue for an overhaul. We need to update our roster of rules, repealing the ones that no longer make the cut. For instance, take the FCC's so-called contest rule. Under this regulation, broadcasters have to give notice of all the nuts and bolts of any contest they run in periodic over-the-air announcements. These announcements, needless to say, aren't the most compelling content in the world, and they can lead listeners to turn the dial. Maybe this once made sense, but not in today's point-and-click world, where listeners would rather go to a web page to read the contest rules, if they want to read them at all. That's exactly what broadcasters proposed as a replacement last year, and no one opposed this common-sense proposal. It's time for the FCC to take action on this issue and others like it. I'm sure that plenty other obsolete regulations need our attention, and forums like this are the best ways to bring them to light. What other rules does the FCC need to red up? All suggestions, big or small, are welcome. No questions are too nebby. As you can tell, I'm really getting into this Pittsburgh English. Before closing, I want to briefly mention the issue of media ownership. Congress mandates that the FCC review our media ownership rules every 4 years. We launched our last review in 2010, but we're now in the second half of 2013 and it still isn't done. This is unacceptable. It's time to bring our so-called quadrennial review to a close and to modernize our regulations to reflect the current media marketplace. One rule in particular that I want to eliminate is the newspaper radio cross-ownership rule. In today's day and age, if you think that the combination of a newspaper and a radio station poses a real threat to competition and diversity, then I have one of Pittsburgh's 446 bridges that I'd like to sell you. These are some of my thoughts, and I can't wait to hear yours. You bring to the table a wealth of experience from all facets of Pennsylvania radio. Pittsburghers aren't shy, so I look forward to our discussion. To quote one of America's favorite fictional radio hosts, Dr. Frazier Crane, I'm listening. And those remarks were made by FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai at the Pittsburgh Radio Broadcasters Roundtable on July 24, 2013. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
Before we go over to part two of the DX Audio Service for this month, I'd like to let you know about the auction we're having. It's for a Persus software-defined radio. The Persus is a direct sampling, software-defined radio. It's known as an SDR, and it's a receiver which is capable of continuous coverage from 10 kHz to 30 MHz. The unit is in like-new condition and comes complete with a USB cord, AC adapter, SO239 to BNC RF adapter, software CD, and a manual. More information on this receiver can be found at various sites online, including the manufacturer's site of MicroTelcom, and that is www.microtelecom.it/Persus, PERSEUS, all small letters. The item goes to the highest bidder, and in the event of a tie, the winner will be determined by a drawing. Shipping will be paid for by the winner. The prepaid shipping weight is 1 pound and 12 ounces. Starting bid is $950. Send your bid and contact information to National Radio Club, Persus Auction, Post Office Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado 80047-3251. Shipping is restricted to U.S. only. Bids will be accepted by USPS mail and must be received by November 1st of 2013. All proceeds will go to the National Radio Club, a nonprofit organization for the medium wave DXers.
You're always welcome in Kenyon County.